This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with the longest serving jazz personality in North America, Zia Tamami, who's based right here in our community. Also on the show, Matthew Gilbert. His best-selling book is Off the Leash, A Year at the Dog Park. He was a guy who stayed to himself, and then he got into playing with his animals. And we'll talk with him about his book and the remarkable reception for it. Also, the latest on what's happening with the East Baton Rouge Library System and on the Scott Rogers death, now 5 days after his murder. And we will have Addie Dawson Yuba, a Southern University art professor, to start on a major exhibit involving historically black colleges and universities. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest is Addie Dawson Yuba, Southern University art professor. She's been on the Bluff for 19 years, and Southern University is celebrating its centennial, 100 years, on the Baton Rouge campus, and doing so in a big way. And one of the big ways is through a major art exhibition, and Addie Dawson Yuba is in charge of this particular exhibition. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about the art exhibition and some of the remarkable pieces of work that we will see and admire.
The Southern University was selected to host this year the National Alliance of Artists from HBCUs juried exhibition and a planning conference. They've never been here to Louisiana. And when I got a call from the executive chairman of the board and asked would I consider Southern being one of the universities that they would choose to perhaps, you know, they select from each university as to where they would hold a conference and a show. And I said, well, absolutely. And I got a call back in February that Southern was selected to host their juried exhibition and conference for 2014. And I was absolutely surprised.
Yeah. Artists from 24 HBCUs have submitted pieces for the exhibit, and some of the schools other than Southern include Spelman, Tuskegee, North Carolina A&T, Morehouse, Clark, Dillard, Alabama State, quite a who's who.
Yes, it's quite a who's who.
And the event will start with a conference called The Importance of Art to HBCUs in the New Millennium. The opening reception is September 5th, 6 to 8 p.m., and I know you you want people not only from HBCUs, but from the community at large to be a part of this.
I think the impact of the show, not just because it's at Southern, it should be, yes, it's absolutely open to the public and to everyone, not just in the community. If you can get here from anywhere to see this, I think you will be very pleased with the work from professors from all of these wonderful campuses.
And it is a magnificent collection of work. And the work, of course, will be not only on display, but available for sale.
For sale. The work will be for sale.
And when you look through the catalog, some of this is, it's magnificent.
Magnificent. I mean, you've got some really very noted artists. One we have that is also on our campus, Eugene Wade, that was a part of the historic 60s, 70s mural movement. Will be a part of what the Art Institute will be doing this October that I'm going on for a conference with that, and really recognizing the artist of the Wall of Respect. I think he's on page, Wade, I think I have him in alphabetical order. He might be on 34, 35, Eugene Wade.
Yeah, I'm thumbing through the program right now, mm-hmm. and it is a fantastic array of artistry of all kinds, and it... It's an eye-catcher, no doubt about it. Now, many of these artists will be at
every
exhibits.
One of those artists you see participating on the back of the catalog are already booked into the Hotel Indigo, which has been very wonderful and given me an excellent state rate price to be able to book all of these artists.
And I see one of the artists on display is A. Dawson Yuba. Who would that be?
That's me.
Black Gold Food, Family, and Faith series. This is spectacular. I didn't know you had this kind of ability.
Oh, you did not.
No,
okay,
I did not.
You wait till you see that piece in person. And that piece was certainly inspired by the oil spill.
How so?
When you look at the piece closely, it has besides the female being totally black, in Louisiana, of course, you know, marriage, family, girls marry earlier here. Family is a big, an important part of our culture. I wasn't one of those girls that married very early, but my family, I know cousins that have married. It was kind of part of the culture, that family, you married and you had kids. Mm-hmm. That was the old Louisiana Catholic way that I was taught, you know. But I kind of steered away from that, But the piece just really represents, with the wedding dress on, the solid black of that she was covered in this oil. And again, when we saw the images.
Well, I'm reading this as part of the description of your work, which is remarkable. White Americans have looked at the role of black women from the early 1800s to the 1950s predominantly as that of the mammy, who was always depicted as fat, middle-aged, dark-skinned, and undesirable, at least to white men, but who ran their household. Through the myth of Jezebel, white men could justify their victimization of enslaved women, and white women found excuses for their husbands' infidelity.
Absolutely.
You're getting into some strong stuff here.
I was telling my students in my art history class when I talked about that piece briefly, and my students will be at this course. I said, we want to talk more about this. And it's basically an introduction to art, intro to art. And I said to them, in doing this piece, I'm in the middle, if you look closely at that piece. Mm-hmm. Because of when we think about the culture of what we call this Creole background, and why we have some of the light-skinned blacks, different textures of hair, and what happened during the period of slavery to that piece. That piece was juried into a show that was at the Hampton University of Black Women during the Reconstruction era, and what we had to say about that, and that was my opinion. And this is the cause, as I said, of how we had, I don't know if you've heard of Dr. Gwen Leary, who talks about the post-traumatic slave syndrome.
You say that you believe 98% of Louisianians are card-carrying members of the F Club. That's food, family, and faith.
Yes, sir.
Well, I guess we all consume food. Some of us have families, and many of us are believers. So, yeah, I would say at least 98%.
Not at least 98% of Louisianians, absolutely.
But we take food, family, and faith perhaps a bit more seriously than people in other parts of the world and other parts of this nation.
Yes. I didn't grow up in Louisiana, but it's as if I did. My parents made sure we went to Mass every Sunday. I went to parochial school all my life.
In Chicago. Yeah.
Talking about in the 50s. My parents left here. They probably didn't want to, but when the storm of Katrina, when I told students I identify with that because my parents left Hurricane Audrey in the 50s and lost everything. So the four children packed up, you know, and my parents had a brother and a sister, I think, in Chicago. And when I came back, well, we would come all the time. Mm-hmm. Holiday season, we were in Louisiana. So growing up in Chicago, it was really not that much different than me being here. What I found in my years of teaching in Chicago and throughout, as I tell students, from Missouri, Chicago, other different districts is that more people look like me here than up north.
And why is that?
You have that Creole culture, the language. My parents would only speak most of that Creole French when we were children. So you had a hard time identifying with maybe the Baptist kid that lived next door to you when you went to the Catholic school.
Well, as noted, 24 artists from the 24 HBCUs all have pieces for the exhibit that starts for viewing with an opening reception the 5th of September, 6 to 8 p.m. This will be where? On campus?
On campus, Southern University's Visual Arts Gallery in Hayden Hall.
Okay, Frank Hayden Hall. And it includes work not only from Addie Dawson Yuba, but many others. I'm looking at this piece from Philip Dawson. Says this work urges reverential appreciation and acceptance of all.
Dotson.
Mm-hmm. Urging reverential appreciation and acceptance of all of God's creation. Such perfection comprehended within female beauty without merely rationalistic representationalism. It's Girl with the Blues. It's a nice piece, isn't
it? That's a nice piece. The only thing that was required of this show was that it had a thread of Louisiana in the foreword, as you read what I wrote the foreword for the catalog. And it just, we wanted to see exactly the different styles of artists from HBCUs to share with our students not only what we do, but look at what is happening with artists in other art departments at HBCUs. I think this disconnect needs to happen. I never would have believed, Jim, that Baton Rouge would have gotten an X, you know. When I go to these different conferences, the first thing is, oh, Addie, can you get us a connection in New Orleans? I said, New Orleans? What do you mean? Come to Baton Rouge. That's why I was just overwhelmed that we were selected. Because the first thing they think of is that of coming, New Orleans then to come to Baton Rouge. So I'm going to show them how the Jaguar Nation has really laid it out for them.
Well, it is a special collection of talent. And, of course, much of it focuses on African-American culture, as you would imagine. And it's hard to choose one or two, but I'm looking through the catalog, and it is spectacular as far as the diversity of art here. Who's this guy, Leonard Dawson Jr.?
Leonard Dawson Jr. is one of my brothers, one of many brothers that I have. As I said, food, family, and faith. I'm originally from a family of 13 children. And my brother is a graduate of University of Illinois, you know, and then Arizona State, and went on to want to teach at an HBCU from Talladega. He's now at Stillman, and he's ready to bring that show to Stillman as soon as we leave. I said, no, it's going across the state of Louisiana. And I've had such a great response from it of people that, I live in Spanish Town. So I have...
Really?
No, I live in Spanish Town.
What street?
On Spanish Town Road.
I did too for 9 years.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay, so I've served on the Civic Association Board, mm-hmm. so we're looking at something at the Louisiana State Museum, perhaps. The African American Museum also in Donaldsonville. Various different venues. And then before it leaves the state, I've already made very good connections from New York through Chicago for this show.
All right. Well, this work from Cleve Weber is just amazing, inspired from the exploration of the human figure, emphasizing the illusion of movement. It's called Dancescape, focusing on dance as a subject that has been expanded to include the fragmentation of the body moving through space and time.
That's an absolute beautiful
piece. That is
piece.
A beautiful piece.
The movement of his work, he handles watercolor exceptionally.
And where is Cleve from?
Cleve is from Alabama State.
Alabama State.
And most of these juried shows of the campuses, Alabama State, Hampton University, Clark Atlanta, Morehouse Spelman, has been where most of the conferences has been and the juried shows. So I'm hoping, with their planning sessions, they're coming to look at the facility. Do we want to come back here and do some workshops and lectures and where we can, again, come together, not just African-American artists? As I said, this disconnect with all the growth of what's happening in Baton Rouge, I just think that this is going to really kind of bridge some of the gaps as to where we need mm-hmm. to go.
Well, Randell Henry, the curator
yes.
at the Southern University art mm-hmm. location, says, for thousands of years, art has enhanced and uniquely defined cultures throughout the world. Today, great museums and art galleries to embassies and Fortune 500 corporations around the world have art surrounding us and inspiring us to have further creativity. Mm-hmm. Creativity and art often go together.
Absolutely. I don't know that they're inseparable.
Well, we thank you for joining us today. Addie Dawson Yuba.
Thank you for having
me,
Jim.
And good luck. September 5th, remember, at the Frank Hayden Center.
Visual Arts Gallery.
It'll be this magnificent array of art on display, and it's on display through?
Through October the 30th. It'll run through homecoming, so the alumni, you know, are really gearing up a lot with the homecoming a lot of the activities of Homecoming Week, too.
All right. The Frank Hayden Visual Gallery.
Visual Arts Gallery.
At Southern University. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is Jim Inkster. Happy Labor Day to you. 297-5633 is your number. 877-217-5757. Inkstershow at WRKF.org. And you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. And that music, for those who have followed the career of Zia the Cat, is the remarkable piece of work from Quincy Jones, Killer Joe. And in the studio is the man who's used this theme for 37 years on LSU's campus station, Zia Tamami, member of the community at large. And when you're talking about the jazz community, Zia has a following internationally. He's from Iran and spent some time in London and then ended up in Baton Rouge. And soon thereafter, he was on the radio at LSU. And you and I met 35 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah.
You were a couple of years in front of me. And,
that's right.
You were already a legend.
Well, I don't know about that.
Yesterday, you were slated to interview Frank Sinatra Jr., who doesn't do many interviews. He is now 70 years old, and amazingly, he sounds a lot like his dad.
Incredible.
And as the years go by, he sounds more like his father, and of course, that is the ultimate compliment. What a burden it must be to be Frank Sinatra Jr. And as we know, he got kidnapped in 1963, and I thought he got kidnapped again yesterday.
Well, we waited and waited, and he didn't show, and I was totally, you know, upset. Then he called 1:45 right during my blues show, and I totally lost it. Then I answered the phone, and this monotone voice said, "May I talk to Zia Tamami?" I said, "Speaking." He said, "This is Frank Sinatra Jr. I want to apologize." So then he called back on my cell, and we're going to reschedule that next Sunday at 12 noon Central. And he's going to be at Borgata Casino in Atlantic City. So we're going to regroup for 30 minutes next Sunday at 12 noon.
All right. And Zia is also a board member of the River City Jazz Coalition, as you would expect, for the man who is synonymous with jazz in this city and every other city in North America. You've got quite an array of guests coming this way.
Very much so. As a matter of fact, we were so excited. Finally, we booked Kenny Garrett Quintet. Kenny was a member of Miles Davis' band, and he's going to come with his quintet. Usually we have a quartet, so this is going to be really heavy. For those of you into John Coltrane and spiritual jazz, this is it. And then following that, we're going to bring the best album of the year, female vocalist, Cecile McLaurin-Salvan. And she's Grammy nominated, and she sounds almost like Sarah Vaughan. That's in November at the mansion.
Sarah Vaughan?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, she is incredible. She's only in her 20s. And she got an incredible voice. You guys got to come and check her out. That's going to be Wednesday, November 5th at 7:30 at Mansion.
All right. Now, Zia, as noted, came here from Iran. And actually, he made a stop in London along the way. And last week, we were riveted by the story of another man who came from Great Britain, Scott Rogers, who was in this community about 14 years. A tragic story. His death last Wednesday has generated news worldwide. In fact, last night I got a call from the editor of the London Sun, who was en route to Baton Rouge, by the way. So we shall find out more about the sordid life of Scott Rogers. Did you know him?
I met him once and didn't know him very well, but I watched his show. And, you know, I mean, for me, you know, when I see some British citizens on television or radio, and especially those that they project more than what is necessary to impress people, that usually bothers me. So that
you're saying he did that?
Yeah, well, definitely. Yeah, it's overselling, you know, on the air, just because, well, the people that are in Southeast Louisiana, they're, you know, in his or their mind, you know, they're not sophisticated. So let me put my strong British accent on and oversell. And that, to me, is not acceptable.
Scott captivated the masses. He He was the spokesperson for the Greater Baton Rouge Business Bureau. That group, I'm told, held meetings at his house.
Wow.
Where he died. He was the chaplain for the East Baton Rouge Sheriff's Department.
Incredible.
He had a badge. He was a deputy with the East Baton Rouge Sheriff's Office.
Can't believe that.
Scott Rogers.
My. That's incredible.
And you say it's all because of that British accent.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, I remember in my consulting engineering, we had a gentleman from London. Every time he called one of the chemical plants down the river, they were like, you know, oh, man, just drop everything. John is calling, you know, with his British accent, you know.
Well, there are several Brits here who are doing well and have contributed to our society.
Oh, absolutely.
Like my dear friend, Dr. Martin Hugh Jones.
Oh, absolutely. No.
The anthrax guy.
Well, as long as you're yourself and you're not portraying this aura about you, that's fine. And that's something that, you know, as they say, be yourself.
Well, do you think that this story, which, as I stated, has gained international attention and certainly much local attention, but it might have even been a bigger story if it were somebody from Iran like you.
Well, that or somebody comes from Middle East, then the attention it'll be quadrupled because of ethnicity or the background and all that. But when you're coming from Europe and especially from England, you know, that's something that covers, you know, some of the front.
297-5633 is your number, and the whole town's been buzzing about Scott Rogers, who died 5 days ago at his house. He was killed by his associate, Matthew Hodgkins, who is in grave condition at Our Lady of the Lake Regional Medical Center on life support. 297-5633, and Frank Barnett, our producer, says Barry in Mid-City is calling. Barry, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim. Another great show. I think it's important in terms of Scott Rogers to remember that I think we're all very complicated people. And for years, he contributed a great deal to this community by helping nonprofit charities and others, public officials who would come on the show, and so forth. So I certainly respect what your guest is saying, and I understand it. But at the same time, I think it's important to remember he did do a lot for the community.
He did, no doubt about it, and that's why he was such a popular man. As I said a few days ago, he took this town by storm. And Barry, who is certainly a man who is been around many people, you liked him. You liked him. I liked him. In fact, I know you were featured on his show many times.
Along with other clergy people, state officials, and he would give people a chance to hear these folks, get different perspectives on the community, and so forth. So I'm just, I lament the sadness of his passing, and certainly this gentleman, Matthew, who apparently tried to kill himself as well. Do we know his status?
He's still in critical condition, but he is alive. But he shot himself in the head, so it's doubtful that he would survive. But he has already beaten the odds by making it for 5 days. So certainly, our thoughts and prayers are with him, who, like others, was a victim of Scott's, who came to the United States with Scott when he was still a minor. And followed him to Texas and then to Baton Rouge, and was living in the same house with Scott Rogers. Now, Barry, and also married his daughter, by the way. When did you last see Scott Rogers?
I saw him last the Sunday before his death, when I was invited to his home because I was told that he was in a very severe depression. And would I come and offer a prayer for him? And I did that. I think anybody who would have received a call like that, not knowing this other side of the man, would probably have done the same. He was immensely grateful. The situation was with him in abject sadness and depression. And then a few days later, he's gone. And Matthew, it looks like, is on the edge of death.
Well, my goodness, Barry has buried the lead. You were at that house approximately 72 hours before his death.
That's right.
Was Matthew there?
Yes, sir.
Did he pray with you?
He was very somber, and all of them were immensely grateful for the prayer. I just thought it's important for us to reflect on the good that he did. Do you remember the man who had the pyramid scheme and is now sitting in prison for the rest of his life? I'm having a senior moment, and I'm blocking his name.
With the Stanford?
Yeah. And Stanford and...
No, the other one. Who built so many people, including Madoff.
Yeah,
Bernie Madoff.
I studied Musar with a rabbi from New York City at that time, which is an important Jewish discipline of study. And the rabbi asked us who were studying with him online if there was anything good about Madoff. And the rabbi insisted that we recognize that in his life he gave tons of money, hundreds, thousands of dollars to Jewish charities and synagogues and helped many people. And I think that that's probably an aspect of Scott Rogers that perhaps ought to be kept in mind. Recognizing now the truth of his sinfulness and his terrible behavior. There's no excuse for that.
I just find this so interesting that my friend Rabbi Barry Weinstein was called to the home. Did Scott call you?
No. Matthew called me.
Okay. Was Scott, was he disheveled? Was there any indication that things were unraveling?
It was a very, very sad scene. Just profound sadness and depression. Yeah. And I left. I was only there a few minutes. And then this terrible news.
Mm-hmm. And I'm told that by others that he was depressed because he was aware of this federal investigation into whether he had falsified his questionnaire when he applied for U.S. citizenship.
That is correct.
Did he say anything about that?
Yeah, exactly.
He did?
Yep.
Did he have an explanation?
Nope.
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 Yeah. Okay.
And I offered the prayers, and I left.
Well, thank you, Rabbi, for courageously telling this story. The easy thing to do would pretend you were never there, but you, as a man of the cloth, you did what you should do. Yeah, somebody's in need, you go to them and try to help them. And
And the purpose of my call is to just reflect with our listeners and those of us who were on the show, and this includes lots of very, very fine ladies and gentlemen in our city. I'd like to express my sympathies and condolences for all of us.
And on a happier note, happy 50th anniversary to you and the lovely Linda Weinstein.
Thank you so much, Barry Weinstein. For another 50. And may God bless this wonderful city.
God bless you. And Barry is one of the many great ones who came this way from other places, as Zia Tamami is. Calling from Baker, I think it's Kwusu. Tell me if I'm pronouncing your name wrong, sir.
That's right, Jim. Yes, Owusu is the name. I'm calling Owusu. In for Vazia. So glad that he's on the program. He's really a gift and a treasure for the Baton Rouge community, for all people like me who are jazz enthusiasts. And I had two questions for Zia. One is that even in like the 20s and 30s when African-American families were struggling, a lot of times they found some way to get music into their homes in terms of providing instruments. So what's happening now with the schools cutting out the music programs, which I feel are very, very important for development? And the second question is, what's your take on the fact that in many instances, artists such as Thelonious Monk and others received much more recognition and appreciation in Japan and Europe than in their native countries?
Thank you, Owusu.
No, I totally agree. Number one, regarding... You know, the music in schools, and there are a lot of cuts, as you know. And what we are trying to do, J.K. Haynes Middle School, which is located at 2401 72nd Avenue, formerly Banks Elementary, they need 40 instruments. And what we're trying to do is to get generous people to call Ziegler Music and help to get the rental of these instruments for the kids. And this is very important. Warm Daddy Wes Anderson and his beautiful wife, they are behind the program and the principal of the school at J.K. Haynes. So those of you who appreciate music and would like to see kids learning more about music and playing instruments, we highly recommend to get involved for rental of these instruments. Regarding your question about musicians in Europe and Japan, it's always the case that we take things for granted. So if you go to Europe, people, they know more about Miles Davis and Quincy Jones and Thelonious Monk than Jerry Lee Lewis, you know. And it's the jazz that is the biggest asset in Europe. Mm-hmm. And overseas. And of course, you know, Voice of America, when I was growing up, was instrumental to really promote jazz overseas. And according to Willis Conover, who influenced me to be on the air, and he had over 50 million listeners on shortwave radio, he said that the cause of defeat of communism was because of Voice of America playing jazz overseas. And it was interesting that people, they used to go to their basements and taped his show, and the next day played the music and tried to practice and play jazz in Europe.
All right. 2975633. We've got time, I think, Frank, for one more inquiry for Zia the Cat. By the way, LSU victorious over Wisconsin 28-24 Saturday night.
And quite a game.
Quite a game. Paul in Opelousas. Hi, Paul. Please be brief. You're on with Zia.
How you doing, Jim? Zia, I want to thank you for you introduced Gregory Porter. Early part of the year, had been listening to him for a while, and one of the first jazz musicians I really bought the album. So I want to thank you for that. And I brought a young kid with me. He enjoyed the show. Young, about 15 years old, musician starting. I do want to put this in your ear. Every second Saturday of the month, the state of Louisiana has a surplus auction. In that auction, there are instruments and pianos auctioned off every year. Every month, I should say, every month. And that is a no charge to schools. Schools won't have to pay for the auction. They pick it, pull it, and gone. But pianos, tubas, trumpets, wind instruments, every month, every second Saturday of the month, Louisiana surplus auction. Just want to put that in here. And thank you, Jim, for a great show.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Zia, thanks for 37 years of great radio.
Well, thank you so much. And what a day to be with you. It's my 35th wedding anniversary this morning, and I almost pulled a Sinatra because I was sitting in my pajamas reading the paper, and I looked at my watch. I said, Charlotte, I got to be on Jim's show. So I didn't even shave. I came, and what a pleasure to be
September
with you.
September 1979, you married absolutely the beautiful Charlotte. And the rabbi just had his 50th wedding anniversary, 35 years for Zia and Charlotte.
And God willing, next year we might have Quincy Jones with us by phone live on LSU Radio.
And this is Quincy Jones, who, by the way, was married to Peggy Lipton of the Mod Squad.
That's right. That's right.
That was a fun couple.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you
and
so
I
much.
And I heard Frank Sinatra liked Peggy Lipton a whole lot, too.
Oh, great. Yeah.
We'll
thank
be
you
back with Matthew Gilbert after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we're visiting with author Matthew Gilbert, a man who has written prolifically for the Boston Globe, where he covered books and movies. He's written for Slate, served as the managing editor of the Boston Review, and clerked at the Harvard Bookstore. He lives in Brookline, Massachusetts, the town that produced the 35th American president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Good morning, Matthew Gilbert.
Good morning, Jim. It's great to be with you.
And you've written a book about, of all things, dogs and your affinity for them, and an affinity that came a little late in life.
Exactly.
How did it happen?
Well, you know, I was one of those people who was terrified of dogs for most of my life. I can't tell you why. I never had an attack or anything. You know, my mother was afraid of dogs, too, and sometimes parents kind of hand that down. So I was one of those people who, if I was in a room with a dog, I couldn't relax. And if I touched something that a dog had touched, I would, you know, my hand would buzz until I could get to the bathroom to kind of, you know, wash it off. So what happened was, in my early 40s, I basically fell in love with a person, a guy, and I think just the act of falling in love kind of opens up your heart a bit. And then he turned out to be a huge dog person. Every person in his life, all of his relatives, have at least one dog. He did not have a dog at the time, but I found myself thrown together with dogs a lot, and it happened. Over the period of 2 or 3 years, I really found that I kind of enjoyed dogs, which was great. It was a great feeling, because I think sometimes when you get in your 40s and your 50s, you think, well, this is who I am. I'm never going to change. I'm happy with it, but this is it. So it's always a treat when you do have what for me turned out to be a major life change at that age.
And this life change, Matthew Gilbert, author of Off the Leash, A Year at the Dog Park, came at Amory Dog Park, which is near Fenway Park, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
What happened there?
Well, you know, they say that you get the dog you need and not the dog you want. And I think that's exactly what happened in some ways, because we got a yellow lab, and he turned out to be extremely social and playful. And, you know, I've been the TV critic at the Boston Globe now for about 14, 15 years, and I tend to spend a lot of time alone watching TV. I'm not a loner or an introvert, but I have tended toward that end of the spectrum. So here was this dog, this puppy, who would not settle for, you know, sitting in the apartment watching TV. I mean, he had to play, and just watching him play with other dogs was just such a complete joy that I found that I had to take him to the dog park every day. And in the process of getting him his socialization, I found that I was actually becoming socialized in my own way. So it was a great kind of tug that he had on me, pulling me into that park situation.
But you write that dog park life can be tense.
Yes.
Why?
Well, you know, I mean, the dog park is an unusual subculture because, well, first of all, you're getting people from all age groups, all walks of life, all socioeconomic levels. So it's just a mix of all kinds of people, and, you know, that can trigger differences. But I think also, you know, just being around dogs and dealing with occasional episodes of aggression, it can be a tense place, especially if someone comes with an aggressive dog and does not take responsibility for that dog. But what I found is even more than that. It's really a lovely communal place, a place where I really found a kind of lovely support group and network of people. You know, it's an interesting phenomenon, dog parks, because on the one hand, you're seeing these people every day, so you're kind of intimate. I mean, I've had conversations with people at the dog park that I haven't had with some of my closest friends about life and death and parenting and loss. And so there's a real closeness there. At the same time, you often don't even know their last names. They're sort of a kind of anonymity there. So it's, you know, you've never seen their houses. You don't usually know their family members. So it's this interesting mix of intimacy and anonymity that I have found very healing and therapeutic. Probably, it's probably like group therapy in some ways.
I like the Los Angeles Times review of your book. It starts, dog memoirs are a tricky literary tradition. Writers are naturally solitary people, so it's no surprise they often find close bonds with such loyal social animals that in turn their pooches begin to inspire, or some might say dictate, their written work. Yeah. That's what happened to you.
Exactly. I'm a cliche.
Well, that is
but happily so.
One beautiful specimen on the cover of Off the Leash. Actually two, but the one that you fell in love with, tell us about your companion.
Yes. His name is Toby. He is now 10 and very healthy. He's just, you know, the classic yellow lab. He is a real pack dog. He loves being around groups of people and groups of dogs. He's extremely friendly, and he lives to play. I mean, if you look at him, he looks back at you with expectation, as if to say, you know, are we going to go outside now? Are we going to play ball now? What are we going to do now? So he's just a lovely dog. And the other dog on the cover is a dog in the book named Bertha, who is no longer with us, sadly.
Well, it's perhaps the best book about a man and his dog since John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie in 1962. My goodness. But it's a fascinating ride with Matthew Gilbert, Off the Leash, A Year at the Dog Park, from St. Martin's Press. Thank you, Matthew.
Oh, Jim, thank you so much.
Happy Labor Day to you.
You too.
And now we're joined by two luminaries from the East Baton Rouge Parish Library System. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and our guests this time are two people affiliated with the East Baton Rouge Parish Library, Michael Brandyberry and Pabby Arnold. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
And let's start with Michael. He is the Makerspace Technology Engineer at the East Baton Rouge Parish Library's Mini Marker Fair, coming up very soon, as in September 20th. Good morning again, the man from Pittsburgh. How did you end up in Baton Rouge?
I came down for work, and that job didn't immediately work out, and I ended up doing IT at the library for several years. Then they bought some 3D printers, realized that they didn't quite know how to run them, and handed them off to me, and I went from there.
The library system certainly taken a step forward in the last several years.
Oh, yes.
When you discuss 3D printing, Michael, at the library, this is an advancement. It's something Baton Rouge may have that other cities do not.
Oh, yeah. It's really neat. You basically get a 3D model from the internet, and you use the 3D printer, which basically extrudes a plastic version of it. Sort of like a hot glue gun. It builds it up layer by layer until you have the finished object. It can be anything you can come up with.
Are many people taking advantage of it?
Oh, yes. Our queue originally started out with a one-week turnaround for a submission of a design, and now it's, I think, up to 2.5. We're getting a lot of people very interested in it.
So if I want to do this at the library, how do I get it done?
If you go to the website, there's a submission form where you can either pick one of several designs we already have, or it gives you instructions on how to find or make your own, and then you submit it to us. And first come, first serve, when we have it done, we let you know, and you come pick it up.
All right. That's September 20th. And to contact you and find out more, what's the best way to do it?
You can come to the library's website, which is ebrpl.com, or makerfairbatonrouge.com for more information on that.
Okay. Pabby Arnold, Children's Service Coordinator. And
sir,
she is here to talk about the library's 37th Author Illustrator Program. And unlike Michael, you're a Baton Rouge native. You've stayed the course.
I am. I've been all around, but I came back home.
And as noted, the library system has taken leaps and bounds in the last, it's probably grown more in the last 5 or 6 years than it did in the previous 30 or 40.
I've been here 19 years with the library, and just in that time it has grown leaps and bounds. It's still recognizable, though, as the library.
And there's an author illustrator program.
This is our 37th year. We began 37 years ago, and we've had the very biggest names in children's and young adult authors and illustrators come in. We began with Richard Peck, and then we've had Paula Danziger, Mercer Mayer, Gene Fritz, Stephen Kellogg, the Pinckneys, Emily Arnold McCulley, Last year we had Linda Sue Park, before that Avi, Jack Gantos, Eric Kimmel, just all kinds of wonderful names. And this year we have a really big one.
Catherine Patterson.
Two-time Newbery Medal winner.
That's Patterson with one T, I think.
With one T.
Now tell us about her, and I know she's a noted author.
Yes, she is. She is a very noted author. She began life born in China to missionary parents, and she grew up partly in here in the United States, but she also lived quite a while in Japan, where her first books are set. And she's written both children's and adult, children, teens, and adult things throughout the years, and she's a wonderful, wonderful writer. She wrote with many years with her husband, James Patterson, different James Patterson.
The two T person. So where will she be speaking?
She will be at the main library on Thursday, October 9th, and Friday, October 10th. The 9th, it's in the evening at 7 o'clock, and that's it's a free program open to families, and we'll have her books for sale at a steep discount, which she will sign. Friday is our only paid program, where it's $25, 10 for students, and she will speak from 8:30 in the morning till about 12:30 in the afternoon.
And that's October the
10th.
10th. Now, the main library is not downtown. It's still on Goodwood, and
it
is a showplace, isn't it?
Yes, it's quite a showplace. If you haven't seen it, people need to come down. But let me tell people, when you come, pass up the library and park at the Garden Center right now, though we're hoping in the next couple of weeks, the first part of our new parking lot will be open, so we'll have some front parking also.
Okay. Well, the 75th anniversary of the library is taking place as we speak.
This fall, we'll have our 75th anniversary. We began at the Laurel Street location, which is the Art Deco building that's now the United Way. We built that for a little over $101,000, 1939, and opened up.
This is 4 years after Huey Long died.
Even
when Huey was around, there were no libraries in Baton Rouge.
No.
No? But you were born at the same hospital he died at, right?
That's right. I lay the lake.
I thought so. Everybody born in Baton Rouge at that time was born at the Lady of Lake.
That's right.
And when the Lady of the Lake was behind the Capitol.
That's right.
Where there is a lake. But Huey died there. And our guest, Pabby Arnold, was born there, certainly.
One is
many,
well known as the other, right?
Many years after the Kingfish passed away. But the Kingfish wanted textbooks in schools.
Right.
And I'm sure he would be quite proud of the library system.
I think
in
he
Baton
would be
Rouge.
Very proud that, and as much as we're supported by the people of the parish, and we're very grateful for that.
How does our system compare with cities of comparable size?
Very, very well. We have a very well-noted public library in our system. And we do some things that are envied by libraries across the country. One of the things is with our children's summer reading program, one of the prizes that they get is they get to choose a book to have. And I get a lot of emails and things from other librarians across the country going, how do you do that? Where do you put in your budget? And I have a very supportive administration for that program.
Because it's a university town, we have an extremely literate population. We've got problems in this community, as we know, and part of it is in the education system. But on a person-by-person measurement, I think Baton Rouge probably ranks fairly high for a city of its size and its region in the number of people who check out books at the library.
We do. We have right now, I think it's over 300,000 people who have a library card in the parish.
300,000 people?
Over 300,000. I'm sorry, I've got it here someplace with it. 325,303 card holders in 2013 with over 2.2 million visits to the library.
I remember when George Bush the first ran for president and beat Michael Dukakis in 1988, he slammed Dukakis by saying he was a card-carrying member of the ACLU. Well, you're a card-carrying member, as some of us are, of the East Baton Rouge Parish Library System.
I am. I have a little bitty old blue card that's all broken up, but I know the number, so I'm not getting rid of it.
And the library welcomes all comers of any political stripe. No matter who you are, the library has an open door for you.
We have something for everyone. As I say, if we don't have something for everyone, we will try to get it for you. We have a wonderful interlibrary loan service that we can borrow things all over the country.
Well, you might repeat the information that Michael gave a few moments ago.
EBRPL.com is the library website. The phone number for the library is 225-231-3700. The children's room is 231-3760. Just pick up the phone and ask for the library system, and they'll get you into the library.
All right. Very good. Pabby Arnold, Children's Services Coordinator, and Michael Brandyberry, the Makerspace Technology Engineer, both of whom are preparing for big events coming in the next few months at the Parish Library. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that'll do it for Labor Day. Hope you have a great holiday, everybody. Thank you for listening to WRKF and to this show. And we will be back tomorrow, same time, same place. One of the guests is one of the best writers in the world, John Ed Bradley, graduate of LSU, and also he was an All-American football, All-Conference football player at Tigertown. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.